for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The death toll in Haiti continues to rise after last Tuesday's devastating earthquake. Distribution of food, water, and supplies is increasing, but international relief efforts remain hampered by infrastructure problems and pockets of violence and looting. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the crisis and the challenges ahead as Haiti seeks to rebuild, Robert McGuire of Trinity Washington University. Joining us by phone from Georgetown University, former USAID Director Andrew Natsios, and by phone from Atlanta, Rigoberto Giron from CARE. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us by Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good morning, Diane.
Andrew Natsios, you've helped in many major disasters around the world. What do you see as the primary challenges facing the workers who are there?
Well, the first problem is this is in an urban area, and it's the capital city where the government ministries were, where the UN was, and the NGO headquarters were. And so there's been more complications as a result of much of the infrastructure of the capital being destroyed. The second thing is, because so many people are now homeless, and Haiti had a poor water and sanitary system to begin with, I think that one of the invisible but very critical issues is water and sanitation. If that is not fixed fairly quickly, and clean water systems, not bringing in water from the outside, but purifying water in-country. And the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, do a very good job of that with UNICEF from the United Nations. And those systems are very important. That's more invisible. It's not a good media spin to do water and sanitation, but it's the most important thing, I think. Emergency medical care is also critically important because of the number of people who are injured. Food is the third thing that's critically important. That's important, but it's not as important as the first two because there was already food in the country. The agricultural system was not destroyed by the earthquake, and they just need to get the markets functioning again. And then fourth is shelter. People don't have homes, and there's plastic sheeting and tenting material, I'm sure, that's going into the country now.
Andrew Natsios, he's a professor at Georgetown University, former director of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Andrew, I know you lost a very close friend, Doug Coates, in the collapse of that UN building. I'm so sorry about
that.
Well,
thank you. I was shocked when I read it. I was sent an email. My friend, I didn't even know he was serving there. And Hedy Anabi, who was the head of the office I had worked on Darfur with, and so two people I've known Doug for 15 years, so I was very, very shocked by that.
Now, we heard this morning on Morning Edition a concern expressed by someone in the military that, in fact, what happened here was that USAID was given the go to coordinate this whole effort, when, in fact, it should have gone to the military, because now you've got confusion, you've got competition, you've got lots of people vying for space and authority. What do you make of that complaint, Andrew?
Well, we worked with the military in Aceh and in Pakistan when the earthquake. We never had those kind of complaints. There are stories, I don't know if they're true, that FEMA is actually running things and not USAID. I don't know if that's the case or not, but there may be confusion within AID as to who's really in charge of running this. When domestic agencies are brought in by any administration, this has nothing to do with any particular administration, sometimes the established systems that have worked so well in the past for 20 years we've worked with the military very successfully in these emergencies, and the coordination is done by AID. So I don't know all of the details of what are happening, but I've never heard that before in 20 years of doing this kind of work.
And turning to you, Rigoberto Giron, of CARE, what are you hearing from CARE workers who are on the ground there in Haiti?
Well, similar to what Mr. Nasser was referring to, the need for food, water, shelter. Obviously, water systems in Haiti are very poor, as he has noted. The contained nature of the disaster in a geographical area that housed 2-3 million people is a huge challenge in itself. And the fact that in any given day, in a normal day, the Haitians bring in 50% of whatever they consume in the country. So add to that the need for immediate relief supplies, so you have a logistical challenge in hand.
I understand that CARE has a gender-based violence expert in Haiti. Tell us why.
Well, we feel that there are two aspects of the work that this expert will look into: psychosocial support of people that have been affected either because they lost relatives, they lost their belongings, and the fact that also you have in this type of situations an exacerbation of social violence, violence against women. And we want to make sure that whoever we target, we are mindful of those type of social issues that we need to address in our programs.
Rigoberto Giron, he's coordinator for emergency operations for CARE. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Bob McGuire, looking ahead, once stability is reached, and even that seems like quite a time away, what's going to be needed by the people of Haiti?
Well, Diane, I think we must keep in mind that even though this disaster was in Port-au-Prince with almost 3 million people, the population of Haiti is 10 million, and more than half the people of the country live outside of the city. So I think actually one of the things we'll need to focus on, starting now, in fact, is how we can, in a sense, find a silver lining in this disaster to rebalance Haiti and invest in its people in the countryside, invest in its ability to build itself up rurally. And in fact, one of the first things that caught my eye, within 48 hours of this quake, I was receiving reports from people in the northern part of Haiti that people were leaving Port-au-Prince and even a village 100 miles away, within 48 miles where there was a little hospital, was receiving people from Port-au-Prince. The fact of the matter is that Port-au-Prince in the early 1980s, was a city of less than 750,000 people. It has grown exponentially with unmitigated off-the-land migration to 2.5 to 3 million people now. These poor people coming into the city, because there was very little investment in the rural areas, coming into the city, trying to find opportunity, not getting it, piling up on top of each other in ravines, on mountainsides, and alluvial plains. This is the crux of this disaster, in fact, the human element of it. And one of the perhaps opportunities of this is that these individuals may have maintained contact with their families and their villages, and they're going back there now. We've heard the reports this morning of what people are now calling an exodus out of Port-au-Prince, of those who are able both to move and who may have some resources to be able to afford to get out there, because I understand that the truck drivers are jacking up the prices to haul people out of the city. But in a sense, this exodus may be ahead of us. I think we in our planning have to react to this, and in fact, not to set up, you know, kind of relief operations in the countryside, but to find ways to take advantage of this to, in a sense, decentralize Haiti, invest throughout the country, and rebuild it that way, too.
Bob McGuire, he's director of the Haiti program at Trinity Washington University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Andrew Natsios, how do you respond to Bob McGuire's concerns about the exodus from Port-au-Prince into the countryside what's happening there?
That's a very typical response in any great emergency, is people cope on their own without any aid workers or help from the outside to go back to family members in areas which are not affected by the disaster. Now, we do know, actually, from a lot of research, even in the United States, that people will, up to a certain point, actually go back to their collapsed house and camp out there. But if they can't get food, and particularly food and water, then they will go back to the rural areas. Or if they're in a rural area, they'll move to the cities. So what he's describing is very true. There has been a problem in Latin America, more than any other area of the world, for a very long time, of a gross disparity in wealth and development between the rural areas and the cities. And this is a serious problem in Haiti. It's also a problem in other parts of Latin America. You have two worlds. You have an urbanized population, and you have a rural impoverishment, and people invest the money in the cities. In Haiti's case, they don't even do it there because the country's so poor. And they don't invest in the rural areas. And people in rural Haiti complain constantly about no services at all in the rural areas.
Andrew Natsios, he's professor at Georgetown University, former director of the U.S. Agency for International Development. When we come back, we'll talk about what it's going to take to get Haiti back on solid ground, what the investment is going to be like, and what you can do to help now. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about the aftermath of the horrific earthquake that hit Haiti a week ago. Here is an email from Dennis in Wellfleet, who says, "It makes me absolutely crazy to hear the words lawlessness and looting used to describe the Haitian people's response to this devastation. It's racist and insensitive. If your son or daughter, your mother, yourself were starving, injured, near death, and you took some food from a store, would that be looting? Would these same words be used if a quake of this level of destruction struck San Francisco and wealthy Americans were taking food to feed their families? I doubt it," says Dennis. "Perhaps the word lawlessness should be used to describe the first world's treatment of Haiti prior to this tragedy." Andrew Natsios.
Well, is there lawlessness in the aftermath of emergencies all over the world? Yes, it's not peculiar to Haiti that some criminal elements, including in the United States, I might add, sometimes take advantage of this. I doubt very much that there's anarchy in the sense that the news media is reporting it in Haiti. I'm sure that there are some criminal gangs taking advantage of this in some areas, but I doubt very much the kind of lawlessness that you get the impression of is really true on the ground. But it's also the case that unless the police are in the streets, in any place in the world, you can have issues with this in the aftermath of a disaster where elements try to take advantage of the instability. And that's usually in the first week of an emergency. That sort of thing goes on.
Once we do think about the aftermath of this, many people have asked why food supplies are simply not dropped in. If you cannot get them in by ship, and I know many ships are on the way, why can't you simply drop them in?
Yeah, and I have noticed this morning, Diane, that there are reports of airlifts now of food and water. I think it's a viable response, but obviously you have to know where the people are first and where to be able to drop them. And I think that one of the things with all the attention placed on Port-au-Prince is the fact that a large swatch of the country leading to the west out of the city has also been devastated, and that's another challenge. The city of Jacmel has apparently also been devastated as well. This issue of lawlessness, I'm very disturbed by it because it seems to me there's a tendency among the media to chase ambulances in this instance. And the vast majority of Haitian people are just trying to cope right now. And the heroics of helping each other and being assisted by the international players is what we really should be focusing on. That said, a lot of the lawlessness in Haiti that existed even before the quake was being driven by gangs that emerged. And some of these gangs have contacts with drug trafficking and arms trafficking. So there are elements within Haiti that we can expect to see emerging out of this legacy of the arms and the drug trafficking and also some of the political violence. But I think we cannot allow that to eclipse the heroics of so many people who are just trying to struggle and carry on and make the country better.
Let me add something about the drops, Diane.
Sure.
Unless you have an NGO or a local Haitian organization on the ground as the material is being dropped or parachuted down, you can have actually people will run underneath. This goes on all over the world. It's not unique to Haiti. They'll run underneath, and some of them get crushed to death.
Ah.
And the second thing that happens is sometimes if there's no organized group on the ground to receive it, the elderly and women and children will not get it. It will be stronger men.
People
who are desperate, they try to get what they can. And you have to have an NGO, a UN agency, or AID, or the U.S. military, or some organized group on the ground to make sure that this is distributed properly and that no one gets in the way of the actual drop.
Now, Rigo, wouldn't CARE be part of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, CARE is one of those organizations that Mr. Nastis is mentioning. And in the case of the airdrops, my understanding is that they're being carried out in the fashion that he's describing, where you have a local organization, you have a security perimeter, and then people are directed appropriately to where they are being distributing the supplies. I want to emphasize the fact that the vulnerable population is something that CARE wants to also target, because those elderly people, the pregnant and lactating women, those persons in this type of situations where you have those airdrops are largely excluded. So we don't want that situation to happen. And CARE is actually working in coordination with the UN, with the U.S. military, to be able to deliver supplies in the most effective manner.
And, Diane, if I could just add one thing, I would hope that as this moves forward, that there's coordination to the extent possible with whatever Haitian authorities are available, be they mayors, be they town council people, because they indeed know their communities much better than the people coming in from the outside and can probably help to identify where the pockets of need are and who the people in greatest need are.
But aren't the pockets of need totally widespread at this point?
Well, absolutely they're widespread, but there is decentralized governance in Haiti, and there are people available in these decentralized areas to be able to identify who is who, and also, I think, to work effectively with the international organizations. One thing that I think we need to focus on as much as we can is to be sure to include whatever Haitian authorities are still there in the process, because after all, they're there for the long run.
Andrew Natsios, is the president making sufficient appearances, the president of Haiti? I know he greeted Hillary Clinton when she came to visit, But other than that, the president has not been very much in view.
He is not a particularly charismatic figure. He's a very competent manager, and actually Haiti in the last 2 years has actually begun to recover from the years of political chaos. They have a long way to go. But it was very sad that this particular tragedy has taken place just as Haiti was beginning to show some stabilization from years of problems.
What kinds of stabilization indications were you seeing?
Well, the ministries are beginning to function in some cases. The Haitian government has always been very weak. And there had been two periods where things were beginning to move in the right direction. One was in the 1990s, and then there was a political, when that military dictatorship took over. What Haiti needs is investment by the private sector in businesses and in factories, and they were getting that in the 90s, and then that, there was political chaos. That was about to begin again. They need a middle class in Haiti, and the best way to do that is investment in factories where people get a regular wage. It will actually lift the population. And this is going to set that back, unfortunately, because business people don't invest in the middle of a catastrophe like this.
All right. Let's open the phones. We'll take a caller in Daytona Beach, Florida. Good morning, Tomasina. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Like many Americans, I'm tired of hearing excuses. One of your guests said that we have to know where the people in need are. Well, isn't that what satellites are for? And I remember after Katrina, after it was all over, I saw on television a boat, a craft, called a hovercraft. You didn't need a port. This boat was like a huge barge, and it would actually bank itself up on the shore. You know, our military should have immediately dropped food and medical supplies over the hardest hit areas. It's better to have a hit and miss aid delivery than have men, women, and children dying a week after the earthquake. You know, our military keeps saying that the security is utmost before they can deliver aid. But if aid is withheld, then you will have desperate people doing desperate things.
Thanks for calling, Tomasina. Andrew Natsios.
Well, first, you have to organize on the ground to find out who the people who've been hurt the most by this. Everybody is not hurt equally in a disaster. Some people actually survive pretty well. Some people may have had homes that were older homes that were not destroyed. And you don't want to give assistance to everybody. You want to give it to the people who are in need. That's why you do humanitarian assessments. You also do the assessments because some things are invisible. Water and sanitation, for example, is very difficult to see. It's not a very sexy thing, but it's critically important if you want to prevent the spread of disease or a cholera epidemic. And that could happen, that we've had that happen before in emergencies. And so you have to find out how many people, which neighborhoods they're in, and what their specific needs are, and then what you do is you call forth from the capital city of the country's giving help, or from the NGO or the UN agency or the aid agency, the needs that you have assessed. You do this in a matter of a day or two.
And joining us now from Haiti is Greg Allen of NPR. Greg, I understand you've just left Port-au-Prince. Tell me what you saw there.
Well, Diane, as you know, the situation in Port-au-Prince is bad and getting worse as far as I can tell. I mean, the arrival of U.S. troops is one of the things people have been very much waiting for in the belief that it will help kind of quell the sporadic bits of violence that we've seen. We've had reports of, you know, buildings being burnt and looting last night. We've seen some people shot by police, looters. So that kind of thing is happening. We hope that many people in Haiti hope that the arrival of troops will calm that down. But in the meantime, the situation of people living here is just a calamity. I mean, you've got hundreds of thousands of people, as far as I can tell, living outside in the open. And in some of these camps, there's a large one right across from the presidential palace in a park called Champ Mars. We drove through there this morning on our way out of town, and it's not a place you'd want to spend more than a few seconds in if you have a choice.
But Greg, that people are also leaving the city because those camps have no sanitation.
I think that's right, Diane. Also, I'm told by some of the people I've talked to that people are still worried here about another earthquake, and many people want to get to the countryside where they feel less vulnerable. There's that. There's the issue of the sanitation, food and water, which is, of course, a big one. To a certain extent, there's also the issue of their own personal security, whether they would become, a victim of roving gangs. We haven't seen that so far yet, but that's one of the things that's in the back of people's mind, given some of the history we've had.
And how are you doing your reporting? How are you being received by the people who are in such desperate conditions?
Well, this is one of those situations where people treat journalists like we're aid workers, and it actually makes you feel a little uncomfortable, because I've been in situations where you see people who actually need real help immediately. You know, I was in a camp yesterday talking to a little boy that had a broken leg, and he needed to have his leg fixed. You know, I'm not a doctor. I can't do that. Best I could do is give him advice. So that's one of these situations where, as a journalist, it makes you feel a little uneasy. You almost wish you were a doctor. But people are so kind, they feel that we're part of the people who are trying to help them get their word out. So I've not had anything but respect and friendliness from the people I've talked to here.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Greg, tell me, to what extent are people there getting food and water?
Well, I haven't been out today, but, in these situations, it's always surprising, in Katrina and others, that it takes a few days to get food and water on the ground, and it makes sense if you think about it logically. However, when you're in the situation, it's stunning to people that they're living in these tent camps, and that on, say, Saturday after, for Friday certainly, 4 days after the earthquake, 3 days after the earthquake, they still had no one bring them water. I think that's changed. There's water being delivered. I think there are some limited food deliveries. More is on the way. But I don't see how these populations will be supportable in the situations they're in now. They're going to have to come up with some more formal resettlement camp, some kind of internal migrant camp. And they're starting to talk about that.
How much coordination among agencies on the ground are you seeing?
I think that's always a question mark, and I think that's been the case here. I hesitate to make any judgments on it because I'm just not in a position to say. Certainly, we've seen so many amazing medical groups down here working. There's clinics all over the place. There's not enough medical aid. I see groups trying to coordinate. They've got a trauma hospital that they've started up at the General Hospital downtown, which was a very bad scene, and that was done by some medical groups, including the International Medical Corps, many others. So I think the coordination is starting to come together. But it's still not exactly clear to me that, that it's as good as it could be.
Greg Allen of NPR, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Diane.
Thank you. And turning to you now, Rigo, after Hillary Clinton's visit and after the president came out and spoke there in Haiti, was there some sense among the people of Haiti that truly the United States would come to their aid, not only through care, but also the military, USAID, and so forth?
I can talk about what our staff are saying and what they are seeing with the people that they're supporting. I get from them that there's a general sense of generosity, and the outpouring of support from the international community is being appreciated. In terms of how we're doing that and how we're delivering it, obviously there are still some challenges to overcome. But if I refer to the point around coordination, the fact that we have so robust capabilities in place right now that the U.S. government has brought in to support the effort signals to me that any issues around the immediate distribution of supplies will be shortly overcome. That to me is a significant development. The fact that there is such a commitment from the U.S. government to do this is something that we see in many emergencies, and I'm not surprised that it's the case here in Haiti. In terms of the overall coordination, I like to refer to that question. One of the things that we have learned over many of the emergencies, and this is hard lessons learned, is that coordination is so imperative in any situation like this. And the UN system has been able to develop good coordination mechanisms, CARE and other agencies are ascribing to those coordination mechanisms, and we will see a far more effective delivery in the coming days. That's my estimate.
And then, Bob McGuire, your concern is what happens going forward.
Absolutely, and I'd like to hearken back to something that Andrew said about the private sector and factories. I think this can be a piece of the puzzle, but we have to be very careful about it. As I mentioned earlier, Haiti has historically been a rural country. The factories that were set up in Port-au-Prince in the early 1980s provoked a massive migration off the land. Those factory jobs didn't last. Once the Duvalier dictatorship fell in 1986, the 100,000 or so factory jobs dwindled progressively until in the early 2000s there were maybe 15,000 jobs left. This is a very footloose industry. There was even a report last week of one factory canceling its contracts and shifting them to China.
Bob McGuire, he's director of the Haiti program at Trinity Washington University. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and your email.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
American history has been marked by cycles of crisis and renewal. Today's financial, political, and social issues have many asking if the nation is in decline. A discussion of how and why America will rise again. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about the week after the horrific earthquake in Haiti. Let's take a caller here in D.C. Good morning, Kathy. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, my question is, and comment, I had learned last evening that a friend of a friend's 20-year-old daughter was in Haiti on a mission with a school, Lynn University in Florida, and they're missing four students and two faculty members. So my question is, what is the priority of getting U.S. citizens out as far as finding them in the rubble? They apparently were on the first floor of the hotel sleeping, or some in the gym.
Oh, my goodness. Andrew Natsios.
I actually don't know the answer to that. Typically, the State Department handles repatriation of American nationals. And I've heard stories that it's happened, but I don't know the details of that.
So how would you recommend she go about getting...
I would call the Haiti desk at the State Department. If you call the switchboard at the State Department and ask for the Haiti desk, and they'll probably give you instructions to talk to a particular person who just handles that.
Kathy, good luck to you. And now to Donald in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was curious to find out, You mentioned the expectation of violence, and there was a comment about roving gangs being a possibility. What is the empirical evidence that you have that would give you the expectation that there might be violence against women?
Rigo.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We've learned from other emergencies, for instance, in Bolivia a couple of years ago, where we were working on setting up camps and we provided all the infrastructure, water and sanitation, but we overlooked the social aspect, and we had a lot of reports of people being either harassed or raped, and therefore we don't want to see that happen again in other situations where care is engaged. So Haiti in particular is looking at establishing camps. We are working in 11 of those, and we want to target those vulnerable populations, especially pregnant women, lactating women, adolescent girls, raise awareness with the community leaders that they need to be paid special attention to, and then bring in our specialists to be able to provide some of the specific relief items that they may need in case they are subject to that kind of violence.
Bob McGuire.
Yes, Diane. I think we should note that there has been, in fairly recent Haitian times, systematic violence against women, particularly at times of political turmoil, where men with weapons have gang-raped women. It was particularly bad in the 1990s when the military was governing. So there is this unfortunate kind of fact, and hopefully we won't see it occurring now. It's not a situation of political violence. But I might add that one of the saddest emails I've received in the past day was noticed that three women leaders of three of Haiti's key women activist organizations have been found dead.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Andrew, I gather you want to respond as well.
Yeah, what happens when populations are displaced anywhere is the social fabric that binds the community together breaks up. If you had that happen in the United States, or we had a whole town get dispersed, and there weren't people protecting women who are particularly vulnerable. They don't have their relatives around, the men in the family or the local police department or religious leaders. In most developing countries, poor countries, that social fabric provides a level, not perfect protection, but it provides a level of protection, particularly for women who are unaccompanied. When that's broken apart by something like this, and those social cohesion breaks down, which is what happens when the community just moves to different places, then you have vulnerability develop. And there has been a whole movement in the NGO community and the United Nations and aid agencies to try to put things in place so community leaders are sensitive to this. So I think what CARE is doing is the right thing.
And Diane, if I could add,
sure,
Haiti's social fabric has been under assault for a long time, and the migration has not helped. People have not formed coherent communities in the city, the migrants. And the fact, again, I'll underscore it, the fact that people are returning back to villages may indeed be a way to help to repair some of Haiti's social fabric.
Here is a message from Facebook from Jose, who says, I fear Haiti's problems will truly begin once the focus on this nation diminishes. How can we keep the focus on Haiti to help restore and strengthen the nation? Bob McGuire.
Yes, well, as Andrew mentioned earlier, Haiti had been receiving a great deal of focus in 2009. That includes, of course, the appointment of President Bill Clinton as the UN envoy to Haiti. And I think those of us who follow Haiti carefully were very heartened that indeed since 2004, there has been expectation that donor fatigue or fatigue of interest in Haiti would occur. And here we were going into 2010, 6 years later, and it was actually heightening with the donor conference, with a government that was a worthy partner to work with donors, the forgiveness of Haiti's debt, the activities of Mr. Clinton, and so on. So I would hope that this particular catastrophic tragedy will help to continue the momentum on interest in Haiti. And I think another thing we have to remember, Diane, particularly from a U.S. perspective, is that there are organizations throughout the United States that are somehow connected to Haiti. Obviously, you have the Haitian American populations along the East Coast principally. But when I was in Haiti 2 weeks ago, when I was leaving 2 days before the quake. I was interacting at the airport with a group of students from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, who there must have been 20, 25 of them. They were taking their intersemester break down in Haiti, working up in the Northwest in the community. Whenever you go to Haiti, you see groups like this, church groups, humanitarian groups, mission groups, aid groups. So Haiti is very much for the United States, I think, an ongoing concern, and we've had a complicated but close connection with that country throughout our history.
Let me add one thing, Diane, that's a problem in all of these great tragedies, the natural disasters and man-made disasters, is people give money very generously to the emergency response phase, which is the first phase, the water, the sanitation, the emergency food, the medical care, and the shelter. But then, as it is no longer in the media, those contributions slow down or end. And we have typically in all of these emergencies far less funding than we need in the reconstruction phase. Mm. So if people give money, my urge to them is that they give it for both the relief phase and the reconstruction phase so that the money can be used interchangeably between both of them.
And we at WAMU, at NPR, and at the drshow.org will have a list of organizations to which you can contribute, both now and for the relief effort. Let's go now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Jackson.
Good morning.
Our opinion
is, I think everybody tried to defend the relief effort, but I think it was very poor, and I think we should learn from it, because who knows, the next one could be in our own. So we need to know where the mistakes are to correct it, and then next time to try to not do the same mistake.
The same mistakes. In what sense, Jackson?
To me, I feel like the relief effort as far as the food, the water, like to get to the people who need it, it wasn't well planning. It seemed like it was very slow. After people get food and water, they get very hungry. That could create problems. So they need to have, helicopter could have to drop food or water all over the place. They're, the first 24 hours, they said they were waiting because they have people on the ground trying to assess the situation.
And Andrew Natsios, that has been a complaint that we've heard again and again, that it took so long to get that first relief effort underway. Can you explain why that happens?
Well, in reality, the first response to any natural disaster are from the government of the country in which you're working. The Indonesian military and the Indonesian government was an Aceh before anyone else was, because it's their country. And they had officials in Jakarta who could, in fact, coordinate this stuff. I think what happened in Haiti that's different, that I don't think I've seen anywhere else to this degree, is the infrastructure of the capital city was destroyed. So the people we relied on, would have relied on, to do this quickly, either died or their ministries or their organizations, their NGOs, were destroyed in the earthquake itself. And that is complicating this. That is a little unusual. I'm trying to remember if I ever have seen an earthquake in the capital city that's destroyed the government infrastructure so massively as this one. I don't recall one in the last 20 years, frankly.
Yeah, and one of the things that we need to really understand about emergency situations is that leadership is so crucial. And you lost not only government infrastructure, but government leaders. You lost the UN leadership. NGOs have been affected widely, some of them even losing not only their facilities, but also staff. So the general construct for responding to an emergency in Haiti has been damaged to a
yes.
large extent. And it's important to understand that NGOs also need to take care of their staff. The UN needs to be mindful of what their staff are needing. And all of this in a situation where you have a large population affected.
And here's an email from Sandra in Athens, Ohio. She says, we all know there are Americans still missing in the rubble of the Hotel Montana. I listened to the parents and other family members pleading for our military to do everything possible to try to get their loved ones out. Why hasn't our military taken more aggressive measures to try to get these people out? Andrew.
Well, I don't know what the situation is in terms of the military was ordered in. The president told them. I think that one of the problems is the airport is not very big to begin with, even before the earthquake. So they're having to find other means to get people in. I think it's also the number of buildings that collapse is so enormous that lots of people are trapped or were trapped. But the reality is that about 92 or 93% of the people who die in an earthquake die in the event itself. Search and rescue operations can rescue some people, but the great bulk of the people who have died in this earthquake died the first hour, when the earthquake itself took place.
But they are still pulling people out. So
they are, yes.
The hope is not lost.
No.
Even more will be found. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Frisco, Texas. Good morning, Bernie.
Good morning. I heard the word reconstruct, and I take some hope for that. What I would recommend would be a Haitian-American reconstruction corporation set up by the United States Congress. And with all of our problems here with health care and everything else, we must have some room in us and some economic ability in us to set this up so that what is put up there, if it is factories, are not sweatshops.
You know, it's interesting. We talk a lot about contributions from individuals in this country. But the question becomes, as Bernie has suggested, how much is the United States willing to invest in Haiti going forward? Bob McGuire.
Diane, the U.S. has invested a significant amount in Haiti.
Thus far.
And in past years, Haiti is probably, I believe, the greatest recipient of U.S. aid throughout the Caribbean, and it rivals the levels that go to many larger countries. I don't think it's going to always be a matter of the amount. It's going to be a matter of how it's being used. And I think one of the things we need to do is to somewhat look at the way we've been going about our assistance, largely by contracting it out to U.S. organizations to go in and do projects.
What about Bernie's idea of a U.S. Haiti corporation?
Well, I think it's a good idea to think about. I think also it's been proposed that perhaps under the auspices of the Inter-American Development Bank there'd be a broader recovery fund. But I think another idea that we might want to look at from a U.S. perspective is how Haiti might be rebuilt using some of the same ideas and methods that were done in the New Deal. I think one of the things that, the lessons for me for the New Deal is that where you have massive unemployment, you can help to put people to work, not just to rebuild public works, not just to take better care and reconstruct the countryside, but also there's an issue here of human dignity. And Haitians strive for dignity, and I think it's very important that we try to look and see how we might enable Haitians to get jobs rebuilding their own country where they actually get paid and feel better about themselves and have a stake in the future of that country.
Andrew Natsios.
Well, let me say first, AID has now been instructed by the president to put together, I think it's about $100 million jobs program in Haiti, which we've done in many other emergencies in the immediate aftermath. The biggest destruction, other than the loss of human life, which is the most tragic of all, of course, is the loss of jobs in an earthquake like this. And you can't see it. Jobs are an invisible thing. But most of the businesses in the city were destroyed. And the people running them, many of them were killed, or their investment was destroyed. And I have to say, I think it's a very bad idea for us to think only of the public sector in doing this. If there is no private sector in Haiti, there is not going to be an end to poverty. There's no country in the world that has ended poverty simply through government programs. You have to have private investment. All of the big Asian tigers, including China, which is still a communist system, have done it through private sector investment. You have to have stability, you have to have the rule of law, and you have to have investment if you don't have it. The countries in Latin America that are making the most progress, Chile and Costa Rica, are models of this, did it with active government support and public services, but a large private sector investment,
all
which
right.
you have to have tax revenues to pay for all this.
Last word, Bob McGuire.
But I think as well, as has been viewed in the lessons learned about private sector investment, the state needs to have a role in education, and we need to decentralize and support agriculture as well to complement private sector investment.
Bob McGuire, he directs the Haiti program at Trinity Washington University. Andrew Natsios, professor at Georgetown University, former director of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and Rigoberto Giron, he's the coordinator for Emergency Operations for CARE. Thank you all so much. Please do contribute, help out Haiti in this time of need. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.